Welcome to CSEE's This Compassionate Life with Charles Goodrich. Charles is currently a poet, writer, and the co-director of the Spring Creek Project for Ideas, Nature, and the Written Word at Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon. The many insights that allow him to write empathetically about bugs, building, and being in the natural world come from acute observations of the world around him and his long tenure as the master gardener for the historic Benton County Courthouse.
This is Walt Whitman's A Noiseless Patient Spider. A noiseless patient spider, I marked where on a little promontory, it stood isolated, marked how to explore the vacant, vast surrounding, it launched forth filament, 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 out of itself, ever unreeling them, ever tirelessly speeding them. And you, O my soul, where you stand, surrounded, surrounded in measureless oceans of space, ceaselessly musing, venturing, throwing, seeking the spheres to connect them, till the bridge you will need be formed, till the ductile anchor hold, till the gossamer thread you fling catch somewhere, O my soul. I love that poem. Whitman is my mentor, one of my favorite poems. And I know what he's talking about there. But as a gardener, that was not particularly my experience with spiders. First of all, he's primarily using the spider as a metaphor. And that's cool. We look at a spider in a web, and that's very cool. And it's obvious there. We know what that's for. That's to trap insects that it's going to make its food for. So that's a kind of an ecological understanding. And Whitman was after the spiritual dimension of the spider, that first thread. It doesn't have the web made, but it has to survive. And it has to cast that first thread out. And it has to anchor somewhere. And that can be the starting point for its web. But that first blind, you know, reaching out into the unknown for something and then to begin to create something that connects. That was what Whitman was really interested about. And he was talking about that adventuring forth of the human spirit to try to make connections and understand things. And that's what he saw in the spider's first casting force of filament. Beautiful. I try to point up qualities of insects or other creatures, birds, snakes, other human beings, that are the things which we're least likely to notice and that maybe are there more ordinary qualities. So here's a poem about spiders. It's called Vacuuming Spiders. I admire their geometrical patience, the tidy way they wrap up leftovers, their willingness to be the earth's most diligent consumers of small bitternesses. Sometimes at night I hear them casting silk threads, clicking their spinnerets, plucking their webs like blind Irish harpists. I can almost taste the fruit of the fly, like sucking the pulp from a grape. But when their webs on the ceiling begin to converge, and the floor glitters with shards of insect wings, I drag out the vacuum and poke its terrible snout under the sofa, behind the radio, everywhere. For this is the home of a human being, and I must act like one, or the whole picture goes haywire. So maybe you noticed that I started out kind of where Whitman starts out. I admire their geometrical patience, that kind of soulful abstraction. But then I bring it down to earth pretty quickly because what I really like is the tidy way they wrap up their leftovers and that they eat bitterness. That's a nice function for any animal to take on. And it engages with the idea, again, that I love spiders. I hope this comes through. And I'm very tolerant of them in the house. And I try to be knowledgeable about where they fit in the ecosystem and encourage those that I know are helping me achieve my ends and find ways to cope with those which maybe are competing with me or that are dangerous. But I'm a human being. You know, I don't want them in my bed. I have my limits about how many I will tolerate in my house. We come up against those limits sometimes. There are oftentimes a lot of insects in our house. And then reluctantly, I say, okay, it's time for the vacuum. You follow these things, and it gets very complicated. And these are the moral dilemmas which we live with, and for the most part, try to ignore. We don't really want to have to deal with these things. And these personal encounters with insects are little ways to reengage with the difficult moral decisions about how we relate to other creatures who are, according to evolutionary theory, the most beautiful story we have devised in the last couple hundred years. We are all kin. Literally, we're all kin. So we eat each other. We compete with each other. But we're all kin. So how are we going to square that with ourselves? Well, maybe we can start in small ways with trying to make some traction with our relationship to the creatures we share our yards, schoolyards, and homes with. Although there come a point where I say enough with the spiders, I love and encourage spiders, wish them well in their environment, and I try to stay somewhat knowledgeable about spider ecology. To this end, I just recently read on a blog by an entomologist who had kind of somewhat the same goal, although he was doing it as a scientist, to increase people's understanding of insects and spiders in particular and help them be more comfortable with them and admire them and enjoy their weirdness and their beauty. But he had a posting about the American house spider, which is the most common one, which is the one that most of us, if we are kindly towards spiders, pick up, slip a piece of paper under and put a jar over and take outside and put it out in the yard. Well, he says that's as good as killing them because they live indoors. They're the American house spider. They won't do well outside. They don't know how to catch prey outside. They're not weather tolerant. Maybe in the summertime they'll do all right. I was heartbroken. All those spiders I had carried outside, I felt like I was doing a good deed. You know, I think most people do. You know, they feel like this is a beginning of compassion towards things which we find it difficult to be around. I take spiders outside. And here it is, more complicated even than we imagined. The house spiders often hatch on our front porch and around the outside. And they make a little ball about the size of a gumball of all the little hatchlings, just like a marble, a little yellow cat's eye marble hanging from a beam on our front porch. It's just astonishing. Well, it's not astonishing. It's kind of ordinary looking until if you walk over with a pencil tip and just nudge it a little bit, they'll shower down. That's so beautiful. And then you see that, wow, it looked like one thing, but it's actually hundreds of tiny little spiders. I like spiders, but always a dance how to cope with them. I mentioned how much I admire spiders for being the consumers of small bitternesses, other creepy little black insects. Many other creatures fulfill that function ecologically to our benefit. That's not why they're doing it, but it's to our benefit. One of the birds which I particularly admire for doing that is the turkey vulture. Turkey vultures are among the most wretched birds, hard to admire, a little bit of a gag reflex when we think about how they live, but they're pretty cool to look at, interesting, and oftentimes you can get a little closer to them than you can to other big birds because they're on the ground. They're feeding on roadkill, and so you can watch them. That's exactly what happened on the occasion of this poem. I was out on a hike, and there were a few turkey vultures on some carrion in the distance. I couldn't see what they were eating, some dead animal. And I stopped and watched it, and all but one of them flew away, but one of them stayed, and I felt like I was having this kind of a interaction with this bird. I felt like this bird was interested in me, and I was very interested in the bird. I've never had this happen to me before or since, but I actually thought I heard a voice in my head, which I decided to think that was the bird's voice. And I'm not saying I channeled a bird or anything like that, but I felt like I was being given a poem. I could be the voice of a bird that doesn't usually get a voice in human conversations. So this is a persona poem. It's in the voice of the turkey vulture. It's called Turkey Vulture Talking. It's probably true I think too much, sitting all night in my dead tree. But I'm a changed bird come sunrise, Mr. Transformer, Mr. Capability. So maybe I can't fly worth a hoot, drunk all the time on old meat. I'm honest, reliable. I'll get to the job if I have to walk. Oh, just a wobbly old buzzard, not good for much. Cogitating, regurgitating, ferrying souls across that final river, getting sadder and uglier. Is it worth it? Well, look at me. I've still got my appetite. Well, I was struck by the message that this bird first gave me, that you may think I'm just a janitor, but actually I'm a bit of an intellectual. You know, I think too much, as people might who are in the undertakers of ecology. So I saw this as a kind of a thoughtful mortician bird who nevertheless got enough satisfaction out of his job that he still had his appetite.
I'm hoping you can address your work with the Spring Creek Project at Oregon State University.
At the age of 50, I got an MFA in creative writing, thinking that I would teach creative writing if I could. In the midst of doing my MFA at Oregon State, I was in a writing workshop with Kathleen Dean Moore, who's a wonderful nature writer and is a tenured professor in the philosophy department at OSU. And she has written a number of wonderful books that try to tease out the ethical dimensions of our relationship to nature. And unlike most nature writing, which tends to be kind of solipsistic, one person alone having their epiphanies out in nature, of which Thoreau was the originator, Kathleen's writing often involves stories with her family out in the wild, and so it has a domestic dimension, and oftentimes her encounters with nature are shared among people, and then that adds another dimension, because people will have different understandings of what they're encountering. She had just co-founded the Spring Creek Project for Ideas, Nature, and the Written Words at Oregon State University. The mission of the Spring Creek Project is to bring together the wisdom of the environmental sciences, the analytical clarity of philosophical analysis, and the expressive power of the written word to help us reimagine our relationship to nature. Specifically to bring together the sciences and the humanities to reflect on where we belong on the planet. At the time that the Spring Creek Project was founded, many of the scientists at OSU, particularly those who were involved in climate change or in habitat loss or species decline, were becoming despairing and desperate because, as they would say, we're telling people that we have a problem here. We have all this great science that tells us climate change is real. We need to do something about it. And nobody seems to be doing anything. Why is no one doing anything? In order to make any kind of fully considered decision about how we should behave in any situation, but let's say in relationship to our responsibilities to the earth in this case, it's not enough just to know the facts. You also have to know what your values are and how those facts jibe or conflict with your values, and then you need a story which will weave your facts and your values into something which you can take action on, which embodies it in the context of a real life. The scientists can't do it alone. They need to partner with people who can help others articulate their values. And then you need somebody to be a repository for the stories from the past, from the present, and the future. You need storytellers. That's the mission of the Spring Creek Project, to bring together the facts and the values and the stories. We deliberately reach out to scientists at OSU and around the country. Will help them communicate their understanding, but also help them actually shape their research differently. If they know that values are going to be involved in the outcomes of their facts, then why not think about those at the beginning? New metaphors for restoration was one of the conferences we did. So what do we mean when we talk about restoration of an ecosystem? Are we putting it back the way it was? Or if we can't put it back the way it was, what are we putting it back to? And what was it? When? At what point was it something? It's always a moving target. So what is restoration in that context? And to that, we had ecologists, philosophers, creative writers. There was a musician along on that one. It's always interesting to have a political leader or a manager, land manager. Physicians and healing professionals often have things to say about these things. In a nutshell, we realize what we're talking about is restoring. We're creating new stories about our relationship. What needs to be healed is our relationship to a landscape. So if you could put a wetland back just the way it was and just put it back the way it was and then walk away from it and pay no attention to it, chances are it's not going to prosper. The next developer comes along and may drain it again. What you want is people who care that it's now a wetland and that the particular kinds of birds and frogs sing there, and that they take pleasure in that, and they learn to care about that landscape. Now you've got something that may persist into the future. If the landscape is protected, the people are nourished and feel ownership with that, and they say, we helped restore that wetland. So what you've recovered is a relationship to the land. A scientist and a poet became friends and agree to collaborate in the future, and they share, let's share our stuff with each other and repair some of those torn connections in a real world way.
You're much more than just simply a good student of the ecological sciences. You tend to delve more into what many would consider the hard sciences, like physics. In an excerpt from Grinding Wheel, you wrote, "They say some old-timers could whet a blade so fine it would slide between the atoms of wood or flesh, not cutting, not drawing blood, just probing the void." When I read that, I think how you see the space as an entity and you really understand the construction of these very small things. And I'm hoping you can read for us your poem in that same collection in the Chesnum Country, Thinking the Sky, because I think it epitomizes that bringing together of science and the written word.
I was a physics major as an undergraduate in college, a math and physics major. They all came very easily to me, and I was very excited about it until that crisis I had around political events and my own future, and I took a class in philosophy, and I abandoned my majors in physics and math, and for the next 2 years took only philosophy classes and ended up as a philosophy major with minors in math and physics. Beautiful stories, beautiful stories. Like evolution, one of the greatest stories that we have discovered and told in the last 100 years. The stories of astronomy and physics are incredible stories. We tend to think that since we have been able to see these invisible things and tell these incredible stories about them, that it's okay to make almost any use of the insights from those, and particularly in technological ways, which are causing us a lot of problems, along with a great efflorescence of material culture and a lot of comfort and opportunity to travel and drive and live in luxury. Even middle-class people in this country live far richer lives than the richest people lived 2 centuries ago. Amazing, amazing, amazing. But climate change, nuclear weapons, endemic pollution that is destroying populations of frogs and lizards and are in us and creating new cancers and things like that are very troubling. And we need to rethink our stories about physics and technology as well. those might have been in the back of my mind when I was admiring a particularly beautiful sky in the Chesnum country. So I'll read this poem, Thinking the Sky. The sky's blue was an afterthought of flowers and trees as they respired oxygen into the atmosphere. They also brought along improbable insects to shuttle their pollen. And once there were bugs to eat, birds became thinkable. Everyone who was paying attention knew humans would be along soon. But no one imagined the sky would go gray. That was a little 12-line encapsulation of evolution, probably doing a lot of damage to it along the way. Since the devil's in the detail and the proof is in the pudding, and there's a lot of details and a lot of pudding left out of that one. But we have a breathable atmosphere on this planet because 5 billion years ago, some little algae in the soup, some spark of life emerged on the planet, probably anaerobic at the time and lived in a very different atmosphere. And only through eons of evolutionary development did first plants and then very tiny and simple animals occupy the land surface of the earth and begin from their own respiration changing the whole composition of the atmosphere so that eventually oxygen breathing creatures could emerge. First flowers and trees emerged, and along with them co-evolved insects, incredible creatures in their own right. And then there's that toss away, that kind of funny line, everyone who was paying attention knew humans would be along soon. Well, who was paying attention? Well, we jump over into mythic time for a moment there and say, well, who was that? The gods or humans that were displaced in time? I don't know. But no one imagined, and still most people find it hard to imagine, that we have actually fundamentally altered the sky. On the one hand, we think of ourselves as humble and insignificant creatures, and in many senses we are exactly that. But collectively, 6 billion of us have actually managed to change the acidity of the ocean, to, you know, exterminate entire species, like passenger pigeons who used to darken the sky. We collectively have a great deal of power, and much of it we use beneficially, and some of it we have used destructively. It's time we found new stories to help us face up to the fact that we have instigated a warming of the planet and very unstable climates, and think about what we're going to do.